You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex Tōku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Liam. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with Ryan Hamilton about the Auckland City deal between the council and the government and Cyclone Vianu. I also spoke with teaching fellow in the International Office at the University of Otago, Dr. Balázs Kiglić, about Viktor Orbán's defeat in the Hungarian elections and what it means for the country after 16 years. And for Dear Science this week, our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern, speaks with us about male contraceptives, kākāpō breeding, and osteoarthritis. Liam, what do you have for us today?
For Greenwell today, I spoke to Troy Baisden, co-president of the New Zealand Association of Scientists and adjunct professor at Victoria University of Wellington, about the Ministry for the Environment's recent Our Freshwater 2026 report on the state of Aotearoa's freshwater systems and causes for concern as well as opportunities for change.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or waia mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ko wā e wareware, e āhei ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ēne kōrero āno, hei pakehere roki roki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia te mata te whakaturanga, let's get on with the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we're joined by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. How are you, Kushla? What have we got for us today?
Well, I missed a bit of an opportunity today, actually. So happy World Quantum Day today. So if anyone's checked out the Google Doodle today, you'll notice that it's, World Quantum Day, but no quantum stories today. So today we're talking about a couple of studies that have come out of basically failed sort of drug innovation trials, male contraceptive and looking at nerve growth factor and its relationship with osteoarthritis. And then final one is about kākāpō hatchlings and why this year is awesome. So first, male contraceptive.
Fun.
So perhaps one of the most societally impactful sort of scientific innovations has been the female oral contraceptive, right? It's this pill that's a mixture of estrogen and progesterone, so two hormones that basically thickens cervical mucus so that sperm can't get to the egg and also stops ovulation so there's no egg produced. And it's had major, major implications. There's now various options for female contraceptive. However, male contraceptive, not been so much. There's been a lot of effort, but not a lot reach market. So basically restricted to condoms and vasectomies in the moment. And so there is a lot of work going on about how to approach this problem. So there's approaches that are about affecting how sperm swim, about how they develop, basically trying to block them from leaving the body, not through the physical method of condoms, but within your body. And this new study is actually a proof of concept about a new approach that's non-hormonal, because many of the female methods of contraception are hormonal and they do have side effects and there are various issues, and this is why it's good that there are options, because not everything works for everyone. But this drug that they looked at, called JQ1, was initially looked at as for a treatment for cancer and inflammatory diseases. But it was a failure in terms of the side effects were just too severe. So this drug will never actually be used in people. So this was a mouse study, but what they had noticed was with this JQ1, it actually disrupted what's called meiosis. So meiosis is the process of cell division that produces gametes, the sperm or the egg, right? So the sex cells. And there's a phase in this meiosis called prophase one that this JQ1, this drug, interrupts. And so what they were interested in is, can you actually treat mice with this and stop sperm production, then stop the treatment, and the mice start producing sperm again? Because of course you want these to be reversible, right? This is kind of the holy grail of male contraceptive, is a method that doesn't totally eliminate reproductive possibility. So that's what they did. They basically injected some mice with this drug for 3 weeks. Sperm production was stopped. Then they stopped treating them. And then within 6 weeks, these mice actually were producing normal sperm again. And then they were able to mate and produce healthy babies that were also fertile. Because that's the other thing you've got to check, right? That the progeny are also still going to be fertile. And so they were like, okay, this is kind of cool. We now kind of have this proof of concept of a different way to approach this problem. Now they've identified three new gene targets that they're going to target, where they want to interrupt this meiosis process earlier on. Because what happens is, as the meiosis is happening, the process is going on, you're actually within the testes, there's a blood testes barrier forms to basically protect the sperm cells. So it can make drug delivery quite hard because you've got to get through that. So if you can start attacking the process earlier, you might not have that problem. And so that's what the three new gene targets are about. And then, you know, they're looking at spinning out a company in the next couple of years because they want to keep the R&D going and actually try and get something to market. So they're like, you're not going to see it anywhere soon, but they're kind of aiming to have a patch or an injection. They have something that uses this approach.
It's exciting. A lot of I do like the classic, oh, this didn't work for something, but it might work for something else.
Yeah, no, and that's what happens with a lot of drug development. They often will look at what else does it work for. And then there's like the famous examples of like Viagra where, oh, it works for something else and we can make way more money, so let's market it for that.
Yeah, if it gets it made. But what else have we got?
So then also on the drug trial sort of aspect, where they basically, a failed drug meant that they had to go back to the drawing board and better understand things. And so this is the story of nerve growth factor and osteoarthritis. So osteoarthritis, it affects 528 million people worldwide. And as the populations get older, that's just going to get more and more, because this is the disease that basically affects your joints. And so we typically characterize it as your cartilage on the end of your joints is degrading. So you kind of think about your bones just start grinding and it's really painful. It's a bit more complex than that, and then it's a whole joint disease. But one of the things that had gone into human trials was about blocking the pain mediators of osteoarthritis so that people didn't feel as much pain. And it had been identified that nerve growth factor was one of these key mediators of this pain. So they had some antibodies basically to block the nerve growth factor. And it worked well for some people. They didn't feel so much pain. But some people actually ended up developing really rapid progressive osteoarthritis. And so they put a halt to the human trials.
Yeah, not exactly ideal.
No, not at all, right? Really not ideal. And they were like, why? We've got no idea what was going on here. And so they've had to go back to the drawing board and go, okay, what is nerve growth factor actually doing? And so because we tried to block it, so maybe we should better understand what it was doing in the first place. And so nerve growth factor is also called neurotrophin, and it's basically this really specialized protein that's critical to the development of our nerves, basically, so that we can sense things or that we have fight and flight response and these sort of things. So when in the embryonic development, really, really important. Once we kind of become adults, it's more we see it as this key mediator of pain responses, like for conditions like OA, or when we have inflammation, the levels go up. So what this research study did was they basically injected, again, mice once a week for about 4 weeks. Then they had a control group where they just injected them. So you're basically trying to keep the treatment of the mice as similar as possible, and you've just changed the chemical involved. And they just watched, like they observed the joints, what happened. And so what they found in these mice that were injected with this nerve growth factor, the joint swelled, and so the joint lining was actually becoming inflamed, and it became thicker, and it was developing scar tissue. None of these things are good. The cartilage looked fine. There was no sort of visible changes, but the bone underneath the cartilage became more dense. They started to get these bony growths. You also got pain-sensing fibers grew new branches into the lining and into the bony growths, so you had more pain sensors, so your pain sensitivity increased. And then also they did some genetic analyses, and they found that basically the genes associated with nerve growth, scarring, and bone formation were upregulated. When, you know, that makes sense because that's what they saw was happening, and that it was particularly in the what are called the fibroblast cells. So these are the cells that are kind of in the synovial lining, so the lining of your joint, and they're basically supposed to keep things healthy. And obviously, they were being infected by this. And so they basically came to the conclusion, wow, okay, this nerve growth factor has a major effect on the joint. We still don't really know what happened in the study and why blocking it caused all these issues, but we need to understand this a lot more, and particularly how it changes with age. So, yeah.
There's something there.
Yeah, that was good. I think they were a bit shocked at how things went.
Almost a brutal sounding set of side effects there.
Yeah, I didn't. So one of the things that would be interesting that I didn't really look into was kind of the concentrations involved with what they injected relative to what you get in the body typically. And I'm sure there's a lot of work there to do.
But anyway, wow.
Yeah.
Yay, medicine though.
Yeah.
Osteoarthritis. Yeah. Hey, if I can avoid osteoarthritis, I'll be a happy man.
Yep. I totally agree. Like, it's something to really avoid.
Yeah. But what have we got last?
The last one is super exciting. Well, I find it super exciting. So there's about the kakapo.
I find it super exciting.
Yeah. So I didn't actually realize, but kakapo is te reo for night parrot, which is quite appropriate, right?
Yeah.
It's a nocturnal parrot. So, yeah. Critically endangered. So in 1996, there were just 51 adults. Typical New Zealand story.
Yeah.
Predators introduced, we've got habitat destruction, and we had hunting. And so that's what really obliterated their numbers. So there's been major, major efforts since then to bring the numbers up. And we are currently at an estimated 235 adult kakapo.
It's an increase.
It's an increase, right? It does seem like not much of an increase, but that is actually quite major.
That's a lot of pairs.
Yeah. So there's 78 nesting females at the moment. And so this year has been an absolute wonderful year for hatchlings. So they've reported that 105 chicks have been born. And that's the most since they started recording 30 years ago. I think, was it 2019 was the previous record, and I think that was 85 from memory. And this comes from this year, there were 256 eggs laid. So there's one supposedly still in the incubator. 98 chicks. So 105 chicks hatched, 98 are still alive. So, of course, you know, they do as much as they can to keep these things alive, but it doesn't always work. Not all the eggs hatch. Four have gone to Dunedin Wildlife Hospital for tending to keep them going. Now, these chicks, so we don't actually classify a kakapo as an adult till it's 150 days old, and so that's going to happen about mid-July, and once that hits, that's when they do the official count. So fingers crossed for those 98 that are still going.
That's a big increase.
Totally. At the moment, the oldest is 50 days old, so we've got a little while to go. But it's super awesome. All this breeding, most of this breeding happens on these three predator-free islands. Whenua Hau or Codfish Island, that's just off Stewart Island, or Rarotonga Island, and two in Fiordland. And why this is even more exciting when you consider how difficult this is. These birds only breed every 2 to 4 years. And that typically coincides when there's a lot of food. So when the Rimu are producing a lot of berries that they can feed on and this sort of thing. And so, they're not breeding every year, and the females typically only have one chick per breeding season. So it is a lot of effort. So every chick is really, really precious. And you see these things when you see stories. So, like, there's a story of the Auckland zoo vet going to Codfish Island and looking at a nest and coming across a little chick that was looking a bit floppy and a bit purple in there. And so he did CPR. Like, he's like tiny CPR, you know, like you can just picture it with his finger and like just breathing gently on his mouth. Revived it, got it, you know, like it kind of bounced back and now it's living. And so, yeah, and he's got a few stories of that sort of thing. Yeah, and so there's kind of, there's this really massive asset to save them. There's this year, you could actually watch one hatch live because Doc have set up kakapo cam. So it's a nest on Codfish Island of Raki Ura. There's the female that they have there. And so she actually had two hatchlings this year. One's been fostered out. And so, yeah, made like bird nerds around the world were like watching this, super excited. You can go watch the footage on YouTube. Still live streaming, so I had to check it out this morning. It's very cool. Yeah, so that she had chicks on the 24th of Feb, so it's still young. Second one in March, and yeah, so really just fingers crossed that these survive, because that's
good news. Yeah. Hopefully, at least.
Hopefully, yeah.
Hopefully, good news. Yeah. Wow, yeah. Amazing! Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. Journey into Motet this Sunday and spend the day amongst the grass, soil, and garden with live day farming.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motet, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back. You're tuned in to The Wire on 95BFM.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts, and the one show to know.
We like the breeze, float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
We've done it! We've got our hands on a receptacle more tempting than Pandora's box, more glorious than the Ark of the Covenant, and with more drops than Davy Jones' locker. It's Southbound Record Crate.
Tune into From the Crate every Friday on 95 BFM Breakfast to discover a plethora of oral treasure. Cam from Southbound has dug up the latest new releases, reissues and re-releases. Thanks to Southbound Records. In store at 132 Simon Street and online at southbound.co.nz.
Okay, Meadow, we can't lose again or it's off to the factory. Go, Meadow! Go! No, other way! Don't you want to live?
Gonna get there, good horse! Headway wins the Spring Cup!
Oh no, Meadow. I won't let them take you, Meadow. We'll find a way. I just saw a documentary about a basketball-playing Labrador. Maybe you can learn an unconventional sport too.
Pony Ping Pong with Matt and Aaron, bringing as much entertainment to your Friday night as a Shetland pony skee-balling the table edge. With a mix of mash downs, candid conversation, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong, Friday, 9 till 11 p.m., only on 95 BFM.
At the start of the break there, we had Our God, A Farewell by Tanara Wynn. Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, the government and the Auckland Council agreed on the Auckland City Deal, which seeks to enhance coordination between the two bodies to enable better investment in the city to get the most out of what Mayor Wayne Brown has called the engine of New Zealand's economy. This will see better communication between the Mayor and Prime Minister, cooperation on certain legislation and funding. The weekend also saw Cyclone Vaianu hit the country, with parts of the country facing damage and flooding. The government now has the job of responding to the damage and deciding what needs to change looking forward to future cyclones. This week, I spoke with National Party MP Ryan Hamilton about each of these topics. Just to get us started, last week the government and Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown announced an Auckland City deal. What exactly is a city deal?
Well, I mean, I think they'll vary from region, but certainly it's about highlighting or coordinating, potential or proposed projects, current endowments and or enhancements. In the case of Auckland, it was really a case of looking at what's the current investment going into certain areas. How can government support that or get alongside it? Is it roading infrastructure, building infrastructure? It's really, I think, about being cohesive rather than councils or private or Crown working independently. So it's really about bringing all those things together and wrapping it up so you've got a comprehensive, forward-looking proposition over the sort of medium to long term. I mean, I'm happy to speak through more specifics regarding Auckland.
Yeah, but just before that, is there likely to be more city deals then? Is this something that the government's planning on kind of going through and targeting a bunch of different cities with?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously Auckland was probably first cab off the rank because it's New Zealand's largest city, and I think it's important to get that right. But I think the government's signaled that it's definitely open to others. It wants to see regional leadership working together and being proactive, and often that can mean multiple councils or TAs, so that they're not cannibalising, in terms of priority. It's got to be cohesive and you know, comprehensive, and so that the Crown can get alongside it and support it. Not always necessarily with financial, but sometimes. But sometimes it's also around enabling legislation or other things like that. Like obviously with Eden Park recently, just with that amendment that went through to support more concerts, which is an economic enabler for the city and region. And then out of the city deal, also, you know, an agreement to continue investing in Eden Park, recognising that it's New Zealand's national stadium. So those things working in unison. I was going to say in concert, but might be a bit punny.
the mayor in particular has kind of pointed to the role that Auckland as the largest city kind of plays in the economy. What are the parts of the deal that kind of seeks to take advantage of Auckland's position within the country's wider economy?
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, Mayor Brown said Auckland is New Zealand's economic engine room. And so we're looking to try and, you know, get that firing on all cylinders. So that includes a long-term partnership with the government and the council. And they've said to have regular meetings with prime ministers, ministers and the mayor, obviously the Minister of Auckland, Simon Watts. So that's, you know, that's, I think, just putting a bit more structure around that, reviewing Eden Park's ownership and then recognising it, as I said, as a national stadium, but actually contributing $5 million towards towards relocating Auckland Cricket to Colin Maiden Park, the redevelopment of the Auckland Tennis Centre, and jointly developing destination major event strategies to grow tourism and events in Auckland. So that's, yeah, I mean, sort of harnessing on that Eden Park and the sporting precincts up there is going to be key. But I guess the overlying that is there's a 30-year coordinated Auckland, you know, transport strategy. And we've just worked through Parliament the realignment of Auckland Transport, putting it back with Auckland Council. So there's a little bit more control in terms of Auckland Council, which then makes sense when you've got something like this. You've got one less layer of bureaucracy. And the big stuff, you know, the Waitemata Harbour Crossing, there's some very early work, I believe, going on there. But that's, you know, that's so crucial for Auckland, especially when we, you know, we talk about these storms and resilience and the vulnerability that we have with the bridge that is really coming to end of life. So those are all, you know, pretty key things.
Throughout this term of government, at varying times, there's been chatter about kind of the role that the central government should play in terms of local government, especially when it comes to funding. Looking at the city deal and the funding and the working relationship between the Mayor Wayne Brown and Prime Minister Christopher Luxon, how can we kind of look at the deal as a signal maybe of a closer working relationship?
Yeah, well, I think to those points that I made around, you know, where Auckland's got, you know, long-term investment or they're developing their 30-year infrastructure or transport plans, if the Crown's aware of that, you know, it can make sure that we set policy that supports and enables that rather than, you know, works against it because it's in everyone's interest that Auckland does well. Yeah, the other thing that was talked about was introducing a new Crown uplift funding tool. So where the council is needing to raise significant money and might have to go above BAU and they might use a targeted rate or asset recycling or something, the Crown will consider contributing funding for those projects. So that's a bit of a new, new signal in terms of projects that sit outside the norms. The government's prepared to work alongside Auckland. And I assume some of that might get mirrored through other regional deals as well.
And just finally on this, you did mention kind of the transport plan, the 30-year transport plan. What sort of level of control is this? Will this ultimately be kind of the council's plan with the government's help, or will this kind of be, how will the control be balanced across the plan between local and central?
Well, largely it'll sit within Auckland's remit. I mean, that's why we've got rid of the separate transport authority and put it back under local control for a range of reasons, but a lot more autonomy for the local council, you know, who's, you know, democratically elected. It gives them a bit more certainty with their own funding rather than having to then try and work alongside a separate agency, and arguably there's things where that agency hasn't worked particularly well. I think there was a lot of alignment across party and government with passing that legislation. And so I guess that's a good example of where council should have more control of, you know, local infrastructure, but where the national might have roads of national significance. I think it's an eastern busway and a few other things that will obviously impact Auckland. The transport plan needs to incorporate that, you know, thinking and planning into it, and vice versa. So I don't think anyone's going to try and, you know, it should work in unison, because Auckland Council won't be able to fund it all. Crown certainly can't, but it's got to work in a way that gels cohesively across the you know, local and central government. So I think those are good examples of where it can be done well.
Just moving on, this weekend also saw Cyclone Vianu hit the North Island. What sort of situation are we currently seeing in the hardest hit areas?
Yeah, well, fortunately, it looks like the guts of the storm missed the country, which was, you know, really positive. But we've certainly seen the vulnerabilities up along Northland and through Coromandel and the East Coast, with roads washed out, and of course Cyclone Gabrielle. That cyclone, although I think we missed the worst of it, has certainly brought a lot of heavy rain and flooding, and caused some, you know, serious power outages and road closures amongst some of the isolated communities. But I think because of such a preparation in advance, the restoration of those was pretty expedient, and it doesn't seem like we've had any, you know, too major upset in terms of infrastructure damage, and fortunately no loss of life.
And with that said then, does it look like the kind of in the near future the government's response to the cyclone isn't going to have to be too thorough? Like, obviously, what are we likely to see from the government in terms of the response to the cyclone?
I think we've got really good at gearing up, and, you know, under Minister Mark Mitchell, he's obviously been quite proactive at trying to get in front of it, and it's been good for all those local agencies, the councils, civil defence emergency, FENS, police, you know, seeing that political leadership there ready to support. But I think it's also really solidified the process. So I know he's introduced, or we've got some legislation coming to tidy up some of those areas around civil defence where we can do it even better and take those learnings away. I mean, obviously it's better to be prepared and proactively ready in for worst case scenario. Fortunately, we didn't see that. So we've always got to be careful not to be complacent. But I think we're certainly seeing a lot more of that volatility with wet weather, and it's going to have to, you know, back to that conversation around resilience and adaptation. We're not going to be able to stop the events, but how we respond to them and prepare for them from an infrastructure perspective is only going to get more important.
And just finally, I just want to look at the Wairoa Mayor, Craig Little, has called the state of emergencies woke. And I kind of just want to ask, in terms of both, I mean, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon has kind of rebuffed this criticism, but in terms of kind of looking at this statement and Little's refusal to implement a state of emergency, how might we see the government going forward in terms of if local councils don't want to implement a state of emergency? Does the government kind of have any plans around how to deal with that?
Oh, that would be a question for Minister Mitchell. I think the danger is, of course, is because these are becoming more frequent as people become complacent. And obviously complacency in any area or health and safety is where, you know, accidents can happen. So I think we've always got to lean on being preventative and focusing on, you know, more of a risk-based. But I'm sure, you know, we'll get more sensitive, and as these agencies that I mentioned get better at gearing up, it's I think they'll be quicker to respond. So I think we're only going to get better as a country. I mean, it's councils will have different views, but yeah, Mark Mitchell, I think, is across that, and we'll know how to navigate that.
That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton talking about the Auckland City deal and Cyclone Vianu.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
What's this button do? Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
Last week, the Ministry for the Environment, together with Stats New Zealand, released Our Freshwater 2026, a major report on the state of Aotearoa's freshwater systems based on decades of data. The report highlights both long-term improvement and deterioration of waterways nationwide, with particular focus on groundwater sources and the impacts of agricultural land use and the climate crisis on water quality. I spoke to Troy Baisden for Greenworld, co-president of the New Zealand Association of Scientists and adjunct professor at Victoria University of Wellington, about what the findings of this report mean, and also about the strengths and limitations of freshwater reporting. Our Freshwater 2026 appears to be quite a comprehensive report detailing the interconnectivity of freshwater systems all the way down to their potential health and environmental impacts. How important are freshwater systems to both our environment and human society?
Freshwater, you can think of it sort of as the circulatory system or like the blood flow through ecosystems. It really catches everything that happens, and so it's extremely important. What it really reflects in terms of health is the transport of water from our land systems, including agriculture and our urban areas, through the areas we found most attractive and onto the coast. And that includes sensitive estuaries around the coast in many cases as well. So the freshwater ecosystem parts of this report, or the reporting series, which are covered here, are probably among the most important. And we're now at a point where we've had a series of these reports over the years. And so we can start to see an accumulation of evidence.
And what are the main messages of this report? The report highlights both improvements and deterioration over time.
It does. So the report highlights what's happening, which is that freshwater is getting a bit worse on average in terms of the health of both rivers and lakes based on the best indicators we have. On the other hand, there is some good news. For instance, nutrient that used to cause the most problems in freshwater globally, phosphorus, has been relatively well controlled over the years if the data on phosphorus is good from the beginning to the end of the data set, which is less assured. At the same time, what we really see is that nitrogen continues to get worse, and that causes a range of problems in freshwater, ranging from deoxygenation and death of the ecosystem to cyanobacterial blooms, which are themselves toxic. And we still have a lot of problems with areas of water that have too many pathogens for safe swimming or contact recreation.
So would you say these are generally causes or concerns compared to previous reports?
Yes. Essentially, it's one of those problems like climate change that continues to get worse despite attention being paid to it.
Why are we only now focusing on groundwater, and what does it add to the picture?
Yeah, good question. So groundwater is really important because in many cases, it's the unseen part of our freshwater ecosystems. You may have noticed if you go out to a river or stream on a sunny day, there's still water flowing in it, and that water comes from groundwater. Groundwater can have a range of lag times before that water comes out in our rivers and streams, and some of it flows directly into lakes or into estuaries as well. And so groundwater is often a store of both water and the pollution in water that can last for a few years, a few days, or perhaps centuries.
What are the causes of the changes that we see in the reports? What is the impact of humans and the climate crisis?
The biggest single driver of water problems in New Zealand remains excess of nitrogen use in farming. And that's really nitrogen that we obviously didn't need to use because we lost it to water. That often is associated in dairying in particular, noting that dairy cattle have increased 71% since 1990. It's often associated with the use of urea as well, and often associated with late autumn, winter, and early spring when the soils are saturated. And ryegrass in particular contains more nitrogen than the animals want to produce milk.
So does this report suggest that we should change the way we do agriculture?
That's the part that's missing, and we hope that future reports will begin to take a more pointed look at what we can do to mitigate the problem. It does draw some evidence together to point at what the causes are, though.
The report also talked about the health effects. What is the impact on humans of these changing freshwater systems?
So the main impact on humans depends on what you're exposed to. The general advice around most of the country is don't go swimming for within about 3 days after a storm that produces cloudy water in the riverways. And that's because pathogens are carried off of fields that contain agricultural excrement, basically. And that when it washes into water, it takes some time to clear out of the system, either by sedimentation or sunlight sterilizing it or being filtered through sediments in freshwater systems. If you don't heed that advice, you get somewhere between sick and very sick.
Right, right.
The worst case was what we saw in Havelock North some years ago. Oh, it's over a decade ago now, but thousands of people were sickened by contamination of their drinking water.
Mm-hmm. And in the wake of Cyclone Vianu, are we seeing extreme weather events worsening the state of our freshwater systems?
To some degree, yes. So as cyclone events and other storms increase in intensity, we also see many of these being associated with the atmospheric rivers that help bring moisture from the tropics with higher and higher intensity as climate change increases. And those increasing storms cause increasing levels of landslides and erosion in areas of New Zealand that we haven't taken appropriate mitigation measures in.
Do we really understand the ramifications of some of these findings, like, for example, the impact of microplastics and PFAS?
So there's a few mentions of microplastics, but as I mentioned, the report doesn't pay for the data it needs to evaluate the state of the environment. As a result, there's no substantial national data set on microplastics in the environment as yet. There have been some surveys, for example, of forever chemicals in groundwater, and those are reported.
Our freshwater was first released in 2017, and there's been numerous reports. How important is long-term monitoring and data gathering for freshwater systems? And are we doing a good enough job?
Great question. So the process of actually doing the monitoring and gathering the data for these reports isn't directly linked to the fundings for doing the reports themselves. And so it's something that is left a bit to chance in New Zealand. It's currently done largely by regional councils with decreasing effort from central government and the agencies like NIWA that's become Earth Sciences New Zealand that would provide a standardized and high-quality rubric for making sure the information is consistent over time. So the number of sites we've got with highly consistent data back to 1990 is actually decreasing, despite the evidence that the problem is bad and getting worse.
Are there any major omissions from this report?
Well, the most concerning sort of omission that the MFE continues to do a better job with awaits new legislation that makes sure that the reporting series doesn't just report on the pressures, the state, and impacts in the environment. It actually begins to look at what we can do about it. What should the responses be? And then how does that affect the drivers of the system? And that is a recommendation from the Parliamentary Commissioner of the Environment that some years past now. And the previous government had that legislation almost ready to go. It remains on the docket. So that's the biggest single omission from the report. In general, the report keeps picking up new information when it's available. And in this case, groundwater is not an omission, which is exciting to see, and in fact is continuing to have better and better data over time. The other omission from the report to a certain degree is the lack of models that help us understand what we can do about the problem.
What can we change? Where do you see hope for improvement of this report? Do you think it will motivate people to change things?
I would like to hope it does. It's challenging to get people interested in addressing slow-burning problems, and water quality is a slow-burning problem. We know that other nations have made improvements. We know that we've made improvements in some catchments and areas, but we, on average, aren't making improvements. Environment Canterbury, the regional council, recently declared a nitrate emergency because it's getting worse to the point where a lot of water in Canterbury is no longer drinkable. But does that really help? It's an interesting case where it's raised the level of profile the issue receives. But in general, framing things as an emergency triggers the wrong psychological responses in us to make a difference on long-term problems.
Right, so what would the correct framing, I guess, be?
Well, the correct framing is probably the framing we use for climate change, where we identify carefully what the best long-term solutions to the long-term problem would be. And for example, in the Paris framework, that involves beginning to embed emissions reductions as well as adaptation and impacts measures to help people in the financial system. That involves making things like carbon pricing real, as well as the incentives that should come to help people reduce their emissions where it's not immediately profitable for them to do so.
And do you think New Zealand has the capacity of restoring our waterways?
We do, and some of our international consumers of our products, the biggest single example being Nestle, which buys much of the milk powder produced by Fonterra and our dairy farmers, is very interested in environment. It's interested in both the greenhouse gas emissions from farms, as well as to some degree the freshwater consequences of farming, and the two are linked, so better farm management will fix both problems.
That was Professor Troy Baisden speaking about the Ministry for the Environment's latest report on New Zealand's freshwater systems.
That was The Green World.
On Sunday, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán suffered an election defeat heralding the end of his 16-year regime that has seen his government come under fire for a variety of claims regarding illiberal and anti-democratic nature of his leadership. With the Tisza Party, led by Peter Magyar, winning 138 seats to Orbán's 55, the election signals a rejection of Orbán's platform, which has seen both an authoritarian domestic approach and Hungary often working in opposition to the EU in favour of Russia. I spoke with teaching fellow for the International Office at the University of Otago, Dr. Balázs Kiglić, about the election and what Magyar's victory might mean for Hungary, both domestically and internationally. Just to get us started, Orbán has been in power for 16 years in Hungary. Coming up to this election, what was sort of the attitude towards kind of his regime, I guess?
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of hard to tell because during these 16 years, Orbán basically managed to create what is called an illiberal democratic system, and part of that was to restructure the court system, rewrite the constitution, centralize national media or state media, centralize education. So I think it was kind of hard to tell what was going to happen in the elections, but I think the election results clearly spoke or it showed that people really, really voted for change. So I think there was a record turnout of 80% or around 80%. And I think that people really thought that, I mean, at least a lot of people probably thought that this is kind of a last chance for Hungary to reorient itself. So I think a lot of people thought that it is an election where they have to vote between authoritarianism and democracy, East and West, and where Hungary's foreign policy would align. Whether we want to have a Russian interference, we want to be closely aligned with Russia, or we want to find our way back to the EU and NATO. So I think for a lot of people it was a really distinctive election.
And looking at that then, what sort of promise did we see from the opposition in terms of where kind of an election win would take Hungary in terms of all of those factors?
I think that it is a really, really interesting thing because, of course, Orbán has always had an opposition since he came to power in 2010, and the opposition kind of campaigned on, you know, anti-corruption measures, dismantling Orbán's regime in terms of media, education control, judiciary control, and state administration control. But it wasn't really, really successful because, first of all, there was a really, really successful state propaganda from Fidesz, which is the incumbent political party of Orbán. But secondly, a lot of people got disillusioned with the political left or with the political opposition because they were also perceived as being entrenched in corruption, and they were kind of part of the old political regime. So I think what really changed about a year ago when Peter Magyar came on board, he was actually part and a beneficiary of Viktor Orbán's system because he was the husband of the Minister of Justice. And about a year ago, he came out to the public and he said that, I know that there's a lot of you know, corruption going on in the country. This is untenable. There was actually a child abuse case where it looks like top politicians were also involved, and it was kind of brushed under the carpet. They found political scapegoats, and so the top leadership got away with an actual investigation into the child abuse case. And that's when Magyar, Peter Magyar, came to the, how shall I say, to the public opinion for, and he said that he's actually got recordings of talks that he recorded, conversations with his wife, who was the Minister of Justice at the time, and he said that he's happy to release these recordings. Some of these recordings were released. So I think that was the real change. People started seeing real evidence of what's going on in terms of you know, the political elite and the political regime, and I think a lot of people got disgruntled on both sides of the political spectrum because of that child abuse case and how the government handled the child abuse case. So I think this is really when Peter Magyar shot to fame, and he established or created his political party just 1 year ago. Not a lot of people gave a lot of chance to him, but here we are, just after 1 year of forming a new party, and he basically has supermajority, constitutional supermajority in the Hungarian parliament.
And so how does this kind of signal, I guess, a taste for change in Hungary? Are we likely to kind of see the political spectrum or legislation kind of start to diversify and move towards the left, or are we likely to kind of just see a run-of-the-mill conservative government, but it's just not the authoritarianism of Orbán?
Yes, so I think it's really, maybe we should approach it through a different lens, not in terms of political right and political left. Actually, this is the first time since free elections started in 1990 that there's no left-leaning party in the parliament. There's three political parties. Peter Magyar's political party is central-left. Orbán's Fidesz is a more right-leaning party, and there's a far-right party called Our Homeland. So there's only three right-leaning parties in the parliament. But I think this really signifies, this political result or election result really signifies a dramatic shift or a landslide move towards the different direction, moving away from illiberal democracy, semi-authoritarian rule. So Magyar actually campaigned on a lot of things, including a domestic policy reset, a return to Europe-oriented governance, ending the illiberal democratic system or semi-authoritarian system that Orbán has created. He will restore the press freedom. He will invest in public services, healthcare, education, transport, and he also vowed to remove the Orbán or Viktor Orbán appointed officials across courts, the regulatory bodies, and state media. So I think he will be held to account to his electoral promises. But the good thing is that I think that he's got a really, really strong mandate with that constitutional supermajority, and the people have clear expectations. So it's very, very likely that he will follow through on a lot of his promises, election promises.
And is this considered to be kind of the end of Orbán? Are we likely to kind of see him stick around as a player in Hungarian politics?
That's what he vowed as soon as he conceded the election. He said that he has no plans of going away. He will actually be working in the background, and he will try to keep his electoral voter base together. So he said that in the next few days, their activists will start kind of an active campaign, just keeping his political base together in the countryside and all across the country, basically. But my understanding, and it was actually one of the electoral promises of Peter Magyar, the incoming prime minister, is that when the constitution of Hungary, which is currently not really a constitution because it doesn't provide much or many checks and balances against the overreach of state power, it's more of a basic law of Hungary that promotes Orbán's ideology in some sense. So he promised that he will rewrite that basic law. He will recreate the constitution, and one of the charter, I'm not sure what it's called, not preamble, not charter. So one of the one of the points that the constitution will make is that Orban will, not just Orban, but nobody will be able to stay in office for longer than 8 years. And Orban has been in office for, I think, 20 years now, since 2010, 16 consecutive years, but he was also in power between 1998 and 2002. So it looks like Orban will not be able to become prime minister again.
And kind of just widening the lens a little bit, obviously Hungary has long kind of played an interesting role in kind of the politics of Europe, both in its pro-Russia stance and its kind of anti-EU stance. With Orban leaving power now, you've spoken on it a bunch through this interview, but what can we kind of expect to see now and how Hungary acts as an international player?
Yeah, I think we will see a very clear foreign policy reorientation. Overall, I would say that Brussels has gained a partner instead of an internal saboteur. Sometimes I refer to Hungary as the Trojan horse in the EU, towing foreign interests like Donald Trump or even Vladimir Putin. So I think that this new era, it will be a new era in Hungarian foreign policy, which will signify the end of EU veto politics. So for instance, Orban repeatedly used Hungary's veto to block many of the EU's initiatives. More recently, a 90 billion euro support for Ukraine. So I think this new leadership or Magyar's leadership will signify the end of disruptive politics within the EU. It will likely strengthen EU unity and democratic norms. I think just based on the European leaders' reaction or immediate reaction, many of them hailed the results as a victory for democracy and the return to Europe. So I think it will make coordination of foreign policy and strategy and decisions within the EU much easier. So yeah, we will likely see a shift in EU internal politics. Hungary will re-enter the International Criminal Court. Peter Magyar will likely allow the EU Public Prosecutor's Office into Hungary to look into all the corruption, the systemic corruption and misuse of EU funds that has been going on for over a decade now. Yeah, so overall, I think the EU has gotten rid of its Trojan horse, so to speak. Orban was quite an influential and still is a very influential figure in the far right in Europe. And basically one of the things he said just before the election is that now it's time to win this election and then we were going to, we will use Hungary as a base to make sure that our policy will be widely influential in Europe, and by the end of the decade, conservative politics will take over in Europe. So basically, he promised his voter base that we will take over Brussels. We just have to win this election, and there will be lots of people and lots of political movements on our side over the next few years. So I think he lost a lot of influence in the EU, in the European far right, but also beyond Europe, because he had some extensive networks in the United States.
And kind of just finally to wrap up, how would these changes in kind of this foreign policy affect Hungary domestically?
Well, as I mentioned, there will be a domestic policy reset. I think there's at the moment there's a lot of hope. So I saw live streams of people celebrating on the streets, even on a Monday morning or after Sunday midnight, they were chanting slogans of "Russians go home." They were celebrating, dancing, there were street parties. So I think there's a lot of hope, especially among young voters who were not really politically active over the last few elections. So there's a lot of expectations. I think there will be anti-corruption reforms, press freedom restoration, investment in public services, removal of Orban-appointed officials. So I think Hungary will be back on the track of a proper democracy, European democracy, with universal values or how shall I say? Yeah, probably it's best to put it that way, with universal values. So I think it's the end of a disruptive politics and EU obstructionism, and there's a lot of hope in Hungary. I think one of the biggest challenges for Peter Magyar is that basically, while there's of course a lot of support behind him, most of his new appointees, they've never been involved in politics. And now they will have a super majority in the Hungarian parliament. But these people, even though I believe that they mean the best in terms of public good, and they will have a mission to serve, they will keep the greater good in mind. So they're people with good intentions. They are not really experienced. And they have to dismantle a system that was built over the last 16 years. And I think there'll be a lot of challenges in terms of experience as well. And that requires a lot of empathy, a lot of wisdom in terms of leadership from Peter Magyar, and probably a lot of patience as well. And he will need to invest in his people. So hopefully his leadership style will be not to just rule, but also to uplift people and empower people around him and put his trust into people. So I think we are yet to see how this plays out. But at the moment, I think Hungary is put back on the right track to become I don't know what that term means anymore, but to become a normal country and not a disruptive country that serves foreign interests as well, or that serves someone's personal interest and the survival of a political party. So I think there's a lot of hope at the moment. It is still time to celebrate, but probably from tomorrow the hard work will start and then we'll see starting results.
That was teaching fellow at the University of Otago, Balázs Kiglić, on Viktor Orbán's election loss in Hungary and what change means for the European country.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Dr. Kushnil McGovern, National MP Ryan Hamilton, the University of Victoria Wellington's Professor Troy Baisden, and the University of Otago's Dr. Balázs Kiglić. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got the 1 to 4 with Molly.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.